Today is Thursday, November 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. 15 pro-democracy members of Hong Kong's legislature resign.
Pro-democracy lawmakers were upset because of actions that Beijing took.
Plus, as COVID-19 vaccine trials continue, the importance of wearing a mask during the pandemic.
The mask is the most effective tool that we ever had so far.
And Australia looks into allegations of war crimes. Well, these stories and more next. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports on what U.S. President Donald Trump has been up to since the November 3rd election.
Trump campaign and White House officials say the president's involvement in the day-to-day running of the nation has nearly stopped. His schedule indicates he has not attended an intelligence briefing in weeks, and the White House has been doing little to manage the virus pandemic. Yesterday's visit to Arlington National Cemetery for Veterans Day was the president's first official outing in more than a week. They say he's mused about declaring another White House bid in 2024. Some believe he'll at least openly play with the idea to boost his public relevance. In the meantime, the president's largely stopped taking part in the nation's day-to-day governing, watching even more TV than usual and angrily tweeting about electoral fraud without providing evidence. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A top advisor to U.S. President-elect Joe Biden, who's worked with him since the 1980s, has been selected to become the incoming White House chief of staff. AP's Jackie Quinn.
Joe Biden and Ron Klain have been together for a long time. Klain was the chief of staff to then Vice President Joe Biden in his first term and will hold that same title for an incoming President Biden. Klain was also chief of staff for then Vice President Al Gore. In 2014, he was selected to coordinate the Obama White House response to the Ebola outbreak, celebrating the survival of a doctor who had contracted that deadly virus.
It shows that our healthcare system can successfully identify, isolate, and treat an Ebola patient.
This election emphasizes Biden's focus on corralling the new coronavirus. But the president-elect also says Klain is well-equipped to face the challenge of working with a divided Congress. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Pro-democracy legislative members in Hong Kong staged a final show of defiance in the legislature Thursday before resigning to protest against the dismissal of four of their colleagues in what they see as another bid by Beijing to suppress democracy in the city. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Justin Solomon in Hong Kong via WhatsApp to get the details and learn where the pro-democracy party may go from here.
These pro-democracy lawmakers were upset because of actions that Beijing took. Beijing took it upon themselves to take four lawmakers out of LegCo, out of the Legislative Council here. And they said these members are no longer members. They have been going against their oath of what they signed up to be, to support the system here. And these lawmakers said, you know what, you're kicking them out. We're all out. We're not going to stand for this.
So what was Beijing particularly, you know, upset with these four lawmakers? What evidence did they cite as reasoning to, you know, remove them from LegCo?
But there's a lot of rationale that was given. But one of the main reasons that everybody's kind of pointing to is this filibustering that these legislators have been doing where nothing really has been able to get done at LegCo. They'll stand up, they'll delay votes, they'll delay conversations about votes, and oftentimes those turn into heated arguments. And back in May, there was one that turned really ugly, and some lawmakers were even arrested over that.
Over the past several years, pro-democracy lawmakers in Hong Kong have lost the majority in LegCo, and pro-Beijing lawmakers have had the opportunity to push through their legislation. So with these 15 lawmakers who resigned today, you know, where does the legislature go forward without the so-called opposition sitting there?
Well, look, I think it's important to look back just a little bit, though. If you go back to the summer, there was a sense that the Democratic parties here were actually gaining steam and could potentially win enough seats in what was going to become going to be the election in September for legislative council. There was a real thought that they could take over majority here. What happened? Well, that forward motion was halted at the end of July when we saw two things, right? We saw a mass disqualification of candidates, including Joshua Wong, and then the announcement from the city's leader, Carrie Lam, that the elections themselves were going to be postponed for a full year because of COVID-19. And at the time, to be fair, Hong Kong was seeing a surge of cases. I think at that time it was nearly 100 cases a day, but many argued that was just an excuse.
Hong Kong experienced about a year of pro-democracy protests. So with these lawmakers resigning their positions in the Legislative Council, what's been the reaction in Hong Kong?
The protest movement in Hong Kong has certainly slowed down because of the national security law. Every now and then, there are a few protests, or it may be better to say memorials of protests, where there might be an anniversary of a protest or an anniversary of a time when the police fired an excessive amount of tear gas. So some protesters might gather to remember that moment. And that's their way of kind of getting away with it without it becoming anything too big. But for the most part, people aren't taking to the streets like we saw before. And there's a real fear. People are afraid of this law and of the consequences of it. And you can look at the 12 pro-democracy protesters that tried to escape to Taiwan and were taken into custody in an hour in Shenzhen in mainland, and people haven't heard from them since. So it's worrisome, and it really scares people to go out on the streets.
Justin Solomon reports from Hong Kong. Israel and Lebanon held their third round of U.S.-mediated talks on Wednesday. The discussion revolves around a dispute about their Mediterranean sea border that has held up hydrocarbon exploration in the potentially gas-rich area. I caught up with George Eden Beirut via WhatsApp to learn where the talks are headed now and the reaction in both countries, since they are both still technically at war.
Well, the third round of indirect Lebanese and Israeli negotiation over the maritime border demarcation was held on Wednesday, as you know. The talks were held at the headquarters of UN peacekeeping force UNIFIL in the Lebanese border town of Nakura, guarded by army roadblocks and with UN helicopters circulating above. The Lebanese state continues to insist that the talks are purely technical and not a sign of any normalization of ties. The Lebanese delegation speaks through UN and US officials to the Israelis. The next meeting has been set for December 2. A statement from the Office of UN Special Coordinator for Lebanon said that talks between Lebanon and Israel were productive, which is a first comment of the sort, adding that the U.S. and the UNSCOL remain hopeful that these negotiations will lead to a long-awaited resolution.
George, since you're in Beirut, we'll start there. What's been the local reaction to this third round of talks?
We had a bit of opposing stances, like the Shiite Iran-backed militia group Hezbollah, a major force in Lebanese politics, has criticized the maritime talks. Even on Wednesday, Lebanese journalists covering the border talks in Nakura, south of Lebanon, were forced out of the town by three men who also attacked the national Lebanese TV crew members and destroyed their equipment. Interestingly, one of the journalists said that the men introduced themselves as Hezbollah supporters. Outgoing Information Minister Manal Abdel-Samad condemned the assault, as she said, Taliban and other media outlets are allowed to do their job without being attacked or banned from doing their job or accessing the area.
Have there been any official statements from the Israeli side following this latest round of talks?
Well, the reactions that came out of Israel were usually by the Israeli media, positive in regards to the talks and talks about a possibility of reaching a certain solution in the near future. However, all is now about the next talks are about the Israeli defense minister and alternate prime minister Benny Gantz said on after that he was hearing positive voices coming out of Lebanon who are even talking about peace with Israel. So this has not been really the case in Lebanon openly, but that this is what has been said in the Israeli media.
You bring up Benny Gantz's comment about possibly bringing about peace between Israel and Lebanon. The two countries are still technically at war, and while the Lebanese government has said these are technical talks not aimed at normalizing relations between the two countries, is there any indication that after this maritime border dispute is resolved, because other countries in the region have normalized relations with Israel, that may be something to look at down the road?
We do have Iran-backed militia force in Lebanon, that is Hezbollah, and it is a stakeholder in Lebanese politics. And this stakeholder today has criticized the talks and has been very prudent in regards to any further talks with Israel. So it is really up to the whole political system influenced by Hezbollah to accept or not to go down that road.
George Eade reports from Beirut, Lebanon. And coming up later,
these are incredibly complex events involving actions and conduct in another country in a war.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to scientists, most stars in the known universe are the smaller and cooler red dwarfs. A number of exoplanets residing in a red dwarf's habitable zone have been discovered, suggesting that life may be able to survive on these planets. A study published in the Astronomical Journal suggests planets circling in a red dwarf's so-called Goldilocks zone may not be as hospitable to life as thought. The study authors used NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory and the Hubble Space Telescope to examine a red dwarf known as Barnard Star. Through these space telescope observations, study authors found that this 10-billion-year-old star, only 6 light-years away from us, pumps out lethal blasts of ultraviolet and X-ray radiation 25% of the time. The study suggests these solar flares could damage or destroy any atmospheres the planets may have. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Johns Hopkins University's COVID-19 tracker now reports about 52.25 million confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus. Iran has passed the grim milestone of 40,000 coronavirus deaths, with the latest 10,000 added in less than a month. The United States continues to lead the world with about 10.4 million cases. Texas has become the first state with more than 1 million confirmed COVID-19 cases, and California is nearing that mark as a surge of infections engulfs the country. Drug maker Pfizer's news of a COVID-19 vaccine with 90% effectiveness brought hope of returning to pre-pandemic normalcy in the United States. However, the new vaccine will not be available for a few months, and almost 50% of surveyed Americans said that they will decline to take the vaccine until it's proven safe. Dr. Talal Nsouly, a clinical professor of immunology of Georgetown University and a former member of the White House presidential medical team, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy about the challenges facing the production of the new vaccine.
Problem with these vaccines, they have a genetic material into them. They have to be stored at a very low temperature. Pfizer vaccine has to be stored at minus 70 degrees centigrade, minus 70, no one has a refrigerator. And the vaccine from Moderna, easier to store between 2 to 8 degrees Celsius. So therefore, they will be providing some type of small type of refrigerators that can keep this vaccine at minus 70 degrees centigrade. And this will stay for 4 or 5 days or even 1 week, a type of attaché case, if you wish, that has some dry ice. The difference between the genetic vaccine, mRNA, Moderna, and Pfizer, versus the other ones, the genetic vaccines will require 2 different injections at 2 different times versus the classical vaccine like the one from Johnson & Johnson and Sanofi, one shot will do the trick.
So how long would it take to produce massive amount enough for the population?
They're talking about at least 100 million doses that will be coming out. It depends about the distribution. It depends about how quick they will be able to produce it. But again, I think that the question is how many people will be accepting the vaccine? They did some polling and they came out suggesting that about 45 to 52% of the population, at least in the United States of America, will decline the vaccine. They have some political connotation, which is very unfortunate, and they are concerned about side effects. However, I would like to tell the listeners that these vaccines, if they're approved by the CDC, if they're approved by the FDA, believe me, they are safe vaccine, accordingly to the studies that are coming out. And the number of individuals enrolled in the first phase three study, usually we are talking about 1,000, 10,000, 30,000, 60,000 individuals. So in terms of safety, if they are out at least in the United States of America, they are a safe vaccine. There is an independent board, scientific board, independent board that analyzes the safety of these vaccines. We do not know the name of the experts. And it's a basket of experts. It could be 25 to 40 experts that analyze the safety of the data, the safety of the vaccine, the credibility of the data, not related to the company, no financial relationship, no incentive. And this board is very important. We have it in the United States, independent from the CDC, independent from the FDA. And once this safety board say this is safe and the study was done appropriately, then the CDC will go and look at it and the FDA will look at it as well. So the safety is certainly there.
Can COVID-19 be prevented by a vaccine?
No, a vaccine alone will not prevent it. We have to have a triple approach for getting rid of the coronavirus. Number one, we have to have prevention, and the most valuable prevention is using the mask. The mask is the most effective tool that we ever had so far. If we spend billions of dollars or trillions of dollars to research the coronavirus, the only answer to that, if we benefit from something, is the efficacy of the mask, of a good mask, and that we have to wear it all the time and to be careful and to have the physical distancing, to wash our hands as well. Number two, to have also antiviral coming out, like the remdesivir and others, maybe more effective than remdesivir. They're doing studies on ivermectin and other antiviral agents. And number three, the vaccine as well.
Judging from the speedy recovery of President Trump from COVID-19, how can this COVID-19 be treated?
President Trump was very lucky, to be honest with you. First of all, he got immediate attention, so he was treated immediately, number one. Number two, he received the right combination. And number three, which should be number one, he probably had already an immune system that was exposed to some coronavirus in the past. And therefore, probably President Trump was lucky to have these antibodies that he had on him. Maybe he was exposed in the past, plus the excellent treatment he received.
So far, is there any FDA-approved drug to treat the coronavirus or at least stop its progression?
The only one that has been really looked at it very carefully, and if you wish, approved for emergency use, is the remdesivir, which is an antiviral agent that blocks the replication of the virus. The only one.
Dr. Talal Insuli is a clinical professor of immunology at Georgetown University. He was speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. The U.S. Treasury Department and China-based ByteDance say that they are focused on resolving a battle over U.S. security concerns that prompted President Donald Trump to order the company to divest its popular TikTok app by Thursday. Trump signed an August 14th order, setting a 90-day deadline as he alleged that if the app remains under the control of a Chinese company, the Chinese government could spy on TikTok users. TikTok says it is not a security threat. It has been pursuing an agreement with Oracle and Walmart to shift TikTok's U.S. operations to a new company and has asked for an extension. A bomb explosion in Afghanistan's volatile southern Helmand province Thursday killed a reporter working for Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Afghan service, Radio Azadi. Afghan officials said the slain journalist, Elias Dayi, and his brother were traveling to the press club in the provincial capital when a magnetic explosive device ripped through their car. The blast injured his brother and two others. Dayi had been reporting from Helmand for more than a decade for the Afghan branch of the U.S. government's Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's external broadcast services. No one immediately took responsibility for the early morning bombing in Lashkar Gah, which has been under attack from Taliban insurgents for almost a month. Ghana's former leader, Jerry Rawlings, who seized power twice in military coups but went on to bring democratic rule to the West African country, has died at the age of 73. Rawlings overthrew General Frederick Akufo in 1979 when he was an army lieutenant. He handed over power to civilian rule soon after, but then led another coup 2 years later, decrying the government's corruption and weak leadership. The Reuters source at the presidency said Rawlings had died on Thursday morning, but provided no further details. Australia will appoint a special investigator with the power to prosecute allegations of war crimes by its troops in Afghanistan. Phil Mercer reports that the move follows a four-year investigation by the government-appointed Inspector General of the Australian Defence Force into the conduct of Australian Special Forces between 2005 and 2016.
The War Crimes Inquiry focused on allegations of brutality and the unlawful killing of civilians by elite Australian troops in Afghanistan. It examined 55 incidents of alleged breaches of the laws of armed conflict over more than a decade. It didn't look at decisions made in the heat of battle, but rather the treatment of individuals who were clearly either non-combatants or no longer part of the conflict. Criminal prosecutions and military sanctions could follow. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the inquiry has been a long and painstaking process.
These are incredibly complex events involving actions and conduct in another country in a war. That is not a simple process in terms of the evidence gathering. There are language difficulties, there are international law issues. This is not a simple matter.
The special investigator will be appointed in the coming months to examine the report's evidence. It was compiled in secret over a four-year period and is scheduled to be released in a week. It's likely to be heavily censored on national security grounds. Morrison said Australia had to confront brutal truths about the actions of some of its soldiers. The Prime Minister also said a new panel will be set up to bring about attitudinal change within Australia's Special Air Service Regiment and its 2nd Commando Regiment. Media reports have previously alleged a so-called warrior culture within the elite units. 39,000 Australian servicemen and women have served in Afghanistan since Canberra joined an international coalition following the terror attacks in the United States in September 2001. 41 Australian military personnel have died, including several Special Forces soldiers. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. Just point your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Special Forces successfully rescued an American citizen held captive by a group of armed men in Nigeria recently, underscoring the United States' commitment to protect its citizens worldwide. The operation freed a 27-year-old farmer who was living with his family in the neighboring country of Niger. He was taken from his farm by kidnappers demanding a ransom from his father. The United States worked with the governments of both Nigeria and Niger to achieve the rescue quickly and without military casualties. We appreciate the support of our international partners in conducting this operation, Chief Pentagon spokesman Jonathan Hoffman said in a statement. The United States will continue to protect our people and our interests anywhere in the world. U.S. President Donald Trump lauded the servicemen and women involved in the operation in comments to reporters.
I want to thank the Special Forces. It was a tremendous event. It was something that had to get done because they were playing with American citizens. We can't let that happen.
Director of the National Counterterrorism Center, Chris Miller, echoed the sentiment on Twitter, writing, "This is a clear message to all criminal and terrorist-related groups everywhere. that the United States government's reach is infinite, and we will do everything within our great capabilities to bring our citizens home. The United States is committed to the safe return of all U.S. citizens taken captive, said U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a statement. Thanks to the extraordinary courage and capabilities of our military, the support of our intelligence professionals, and our diplomatic efforts, the hostage will be reunited with his family. We will never abandon any American taken hostage.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.